This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, coming to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Today on the show, voting wraps up in the Solomon Islands election, and among those voted in, 8 women.
Especially when the environment actually is very hostile to women candidates to have a fair go at the national election.
Also, Timor-Leste's news coverage is found lacking when it comes to women's issues, and Pacific health experts converge on Melbourne for the World Health Summit. All that and more today on the show. I'm Kyle Evans. Thanks for tuning in. But first, Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister James Marape and Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese will set off today on the second leg of their historic trek along the Kokoda Track ahead of Anzac Day commemorations tomorrow. The pair camped overnight at Hoi Village and will this morning trek about 10 kilometres to the Surava Village for a dawn service tomorrow. The visit has caused quite a stir locally, and the ABC's PNG reporter Belinda Cora has been following all the reactions, and she joins us on the line now. Bells, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me, Kyle.
Not a problem. We've seen pictures come through of Mr. Albanese being given an extravagant welcome in Kokoda Village yesterday. How big of a deal has this visit been for local villagers in the region?
A very important question, especially when we're speaking about a very historic track that has been a continued bridge between the two countries. On ground itself, when I spoke to Governor Gary Joffa of Oro Province, he highlighted how vital it was for the first Australian Prime Minister to finally interact face-to-face with the communities along the track in Kokoda. Mr. Joffa reiterated how important it was for Mr. Albanese to speak to the people there directly and see for himself the plight of the people of Kokoda. You can see from the pictures how Mr. Albanese's presence was embraced by the villagers the Oro way, despite challenges that are still being echoed and are also still being have been some of the biggest challenges in the last couple of years. They've also been praised for Prime Minister James Marape for also accompanying the Australian Prime Minister, which many thought was a PNG passing or a way of PNG. And there have also been concerns by some as to who the Australian Prime Minister was here to remember during Anzac Day. But Mr. Albanese had stated clearly that the Australians and Papuans and New Guineans fought alongside one another across this landscape, and he would honour both on Anzac Day.
And how did he react to his reception? I saw the videos of him being welcomed, you know, by a traditional dance. And I guess, secondly, what kind of shape was he in after the hike?
I know. I did see some of the pictures and the videos that were actually posted here in our Prime Minister's media page. And he looked very, very excited, very overwhelmed with the tapa cloth that he was able to wear from the Kokoda women who were able to present that to him, recognizing him and as a leader in arriving in Kokoda. He seemed very, very calm, very collected, and very excited to meet the villagers along the track as well.
Let's talk generally about the visit. What have people in PNG been saying about his visit and its meaning behind it?
Yes, a lot of people were concerned, just a few people were concerned about what this visit was trying to reflect, and especially what he was here to also commemorate. Was it for the Fuzzy Wuzzy or was it for the Australian soldiers themselves? But he clearly indicated in his visit and also when he arrived here in Papua New Guinea that he was actually here to honour both the soldiers, and that was clearly indicated in many of the statements. And people, the general public in Port Moresby, especially around the country, were very appreciative of that kind gesture that he was able to also state that in his statement.
That's good news. Both sides did fight very hard after all. You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Kyle Evans and I'm chatting with ABC's PNG reporter Belinda Cora, who has been following James Marape and Anthony Albanese's journey up the Kokoda Trail. Now, this visit comes hot on the heels of China's foreign affairs minister visiting the country. Was the timing of Mr. Albanese's trip just a coincidence, or was it well-timed?
Very interesting question, Kyle. I wouldn't be able to comment or confirm this coincidence. However, the Prime Minister, James Marape, had said that they didn't plan to have this back-to-back visit and that Papua New Guinea was simply blessed. He told the reporters this during the visit and the arrival of the Foreign Minister of China, Wang Yi, over the weekend. However, in his remarks following a bilateral meeting on Saturday, Minister Wang did take aim at Australia and the AUKUS partnership, a security relationship for the Indo-Pacific region between Australia, US and the UK, claiming it instigated division and was not in line with the needs of the Pacific Island countries.
Well, in terms of talking shop, both leaders are going to have plenty of time to do that on the trail today. What do you think the discussions will center around? And secondly, how much of it do you think is going to be focused on the NRL license?
Very interesting question. Yes, a lot of Papua New Guineans, especially the rugby fanatics, have also indicated the need to have some progress or at least an update on the much talked about NRL license that has been the talk during many of the past bilateral visits. And of course, over the 4 years, Mr. Marape indicated that Australia had spent over 4 billion kina worth of programs that have complemented its government's development budget focus. And the walk itself by Mr. Marape said that both leaders were able to actually, build on the momentum of this assistance and this aid that has been able to help a lot of Papua New Guineans and private and public sector. Mr. Marape, during a dinner at the Parliament House, assured Mr. Albanese that the security of the two countries are deeply anchored in their shared past. And further to this, he also said in a statement that he was able to also have this walk and also discuss further about the future of the bilateral talks that have continued to have between the two countries.
Yeah, no, it's certainly a long walk together and hopefully they're not sick of each other by the end of it, but it certainly is a fantastic time to, for them to bond with each other. Look, let's turn to some other news quickly, because I see the US Embassy put out a statement regarding comments from US President Joe Biden claiming that his uncle was taken by cannibals in PNG during World War II. We covered that in yesterday's show. The statement acknowledged the remarks, but didn't necessarily contain an apology. How has the reaction been locally to all this?
Yes, further to this claim in its statement, it goes on to state that the U.S. Respects the people and the culture of Papua New Guinea and is committed to furthering respectful relations between the two countries. Prime Minister James Marape was asked by the media regarding the comments made by the President, Joe Biden, and he said that the President's comments may have been a slip of the tongue. Now, the debate continues online as we speak, as many have called for the U.S. President to apologize to the people and the government of Papua New Guinea. One MP, Belden Nama, in his statement yesterday had said that Mr. Biden's comments were unfounded, unacceptable, and utterly disrespectful. Now, Kyle, further to this, police in NCD have also condemned a planned protest that is planned for today to the U.S. Embassy by concerned citizens, and we will continue to also monitor this as well for today.
And that is interesting. I must say, yeah, it surprised me that the statement, while acknowledging it didn't contain an apology. But yeah, I guess also worth pointing out as well, they did make an effort to address those how hard the US is working to repatriate all those soldiers as well. Belinda, that's all we've got time for today. But thank you so much for joining us on Pacific Beat.
Thanks for having me, Kyle.
Not a problem. That was the ABC's PNG reporter, Belinda Cora. Well, 8 women will be among the Solomon Islands National MPs when Parliament is convened following the recent national elections. Electoral CEO Jasper Highwood-Anisi says they're among a new cohort of MPs elected into office at national and provincial level.
Interestingly, we have 8 women who have been declared so far in this joint election. 3 for parliamentary seats, 1 for Gela in Central Islands Province, Maringe Kokota in Isabel Province, and Temotu Vatud in Temotu Province. We have 3 seats for Provincial Assembly, Sigana Ward in Isabel, Nea Nole in Temotu, and Luaniwa in Malaita Province, and include 2 HCC seats. They are Cruz Ward and Panatina Ward. All these seats are represented by women. So congratulations to all 8 women.
CEO of the Electoral Office, Jasper Anisi, speaking there. Meanwhile, the election of 5 women at the provincial level and 3 at national parliament has been welcomed by advocates. Ruth Liliquilla, Chief Executive Officer of Transparency Solomon Islands, says it's been a tough slog getting women into parliament, with many facing an uphill battle in an ever-hostile environment.
I think it's good that we still have women rep in the parliament, although we've only got 3 elected, especially when the environment actually is very hostile to women candidates to have a fair go at the national elections. So it's actually good that we have 3 women elected, although still it's all about resources. You have resources, you can get elected.
What do you mean when you say that the environment during the election for women was hostile?
Not only hostile, but the level that they have raised, the campaign practices and tactics to actually influence people's views and how people vote, has gone very, very high, where things like people, political parties and other candidates with money, they turn up at the election campaign period with 40 canoes, 30 canoes into one community or into a location of to do their campaigning, and most of the voters judge them by what resources they have and all of this. It's no longer about the roles and responsibilities of a representative of the people as member of parliament that is being prioritized by the electors, but how much money, how much resources they have if they go in to provide to their voters. So this is how it's been very, very difficult, and it's going to be continued to be difficult for women to have a fair go at elections, because it's all been monetized to the point where good, responsible women, women with integrity, not only women but men as well, to get a chance or to have a shot at being members of parliament.
These 3 newly elected women, they have a big role to play for women and their communities, is that right?
Yeah, these 3 women elected into parliament, it will be depending very much on what it is that the voters gave them their vote for. That will determine very much on how they will fare in the next 4 years. It's not really what sort of good policy, how they influence the decisions inside the parliament. People are not interested in those kind of things. They are interested in on what these people can deliver to them materially.
The slogan for this election was Vote for Change. Did you see that occurring during the election and after?
I think Vote for Change, it probably is an appropriate theme to use, but unfortunately, there was no civic awareness. Voters awareness program is absolutely nil balance inside the communities that we have traveled to, and also we know that it does not happen at the constituency and at the provincial level. There is very little money has gone into that, to educating people about their political rights and the duties and responsibilities that come with those. and also to ensure that the integrity of the election processes are maintained. During this election, there's very, very little you can say that the integrity of the electoral processes has been paid any particular attention. Because during the 5 year, it is supposed to be a 4 year electoral cycle period where the electoral body is supposed to be carrying out awareness of the processes and everything else has not happened. So, yes, there is some changes in terms of members that have been elected in, but I think the Electoral Commission, as well as all those other people that receive the money to do the civic awareness, need to up their level of making our people informed. What I've seen is that for those constituencies, not very many, that have received quite extensive civic awareness or voters awareness, clean election campaign awareness, we notice the changes that they make, the decisions that they make. Yes, there is some changes there. They bring in new members to be their members, but that doesn't mean to say that the reason they vote out the old one and they vote in the new one has changed. I mean, those are the things that will either make or break this theme of Yumi vote for change and all of that. So you cannot change if people are not aware of what their rights are and the power that they hold in their hands, and also what that power is for in terms of making a change in the country and all of that.
Do you see in the future there will be more women taking part in decision-making in parliament?
I think we still have a long way to go. And also the conduct and the performance of women parliament would also convince our people to vote that way. We're still a very traditional society at heart, where there is very little awareness going out about the roles and responsibilities of members of parliament, the roles and responsibilities of us, the citizens, and the roles and responsibilities of the government institutions that are entrusted with making our citizens and everyone else aware of their political rights, legal rights, democratic rights, human rights, and also civil rights and the responsibilities that come with those. But I must say there is hope for the future.
Ruth Lilaquila, CEO of Transparency International Solomon Islands, speaking there. Meanwhile, we can report vote counting is now complete, with caretaker Prime Minister PM Menassa Sogavare's Our Party claiming 15 MPs. So let's head to the capital, Honiara, to try and make sense of the results so far. We're joined this morning by a longtime journalist, Dorothy Wickham. Good morning, Dorothy.
Good morning, Dad.
So what's the atmosphere like in Honiara with the vote count now complete for all 50 constituencies?
I think you've got maybe a lot of people happy with the changes that have taken place in their constituencies, and some not so happy. But there's also other people who are happy with those who have come back in as their members of parliament. So there's a mixed feeling, as you can see from the numbers, that there's no real big gaps between the two major sides in this whole upcoming battle to form government.
No, you're right there. Our party, 15 MPs, but obviously a long way off that 26 MPs needed to form government. Were there any surprises on the final day of voting?
Yes, there were quite a few surprises. I think we didn't expect some of the ones who did overthrow the outgoing to take the places that they did, but they've managed. And I think there's a real sense of wanting change, I think, amongst a lot of people. Mm. However, there's also another group of people who want it as it is. So we'll have to see as we go along and see whether the independent group, who now have the power to influence which side takes the government, how they decide, because inside this independent group, there's also a lot of newcomers as well.
Yeah, so it looks like the independents will very much be the kingmakers of this election, and we'll talk about them in a little while. It looks like no one party has the majority, so how are groups going to go about getting the 26 MPs needed to form government?
Well, lobbying, I think, started well before elections started. Lobbying amongst candidates, the political parties that were putting up candidates over the last week, and even until yesterday, there were already certain MPs being seen at certain camps that didn't belong there before. So I think that there's already some movement, and we'll know that when this number, I think it's the 1st of May when nominations open for the prime ministership. That's when we'll start to see the numbers fall. But, you know, with the elections for the prime minister, it's secret ballot. It can just swing anywhere at the last minute.
Just talking about Sogavare's Our Party again, they went into the election with almost 30 MPs. Now it only has 15. That being said, they still have the largest representation. Does that mean they have the biggest chance at forming government?
Yeah, you would think so. I mean, that's what I'm saying. If you're looking at their numbers and the CARE numbers, and then you're looking at the independent group or the other little numbers that pop up under the other parties, there is a possibility. If they're able to convince some of these newcomers to join them, then they might swing it their way.
So let's talk about some of the newcomers. Obviously, CARE Coalition has 13 MPs. United Party has 7 with those 15 independents. How much influence are they going to get to have with producing this coalition?
I think they'll have a lot. And also the fact that they're very young. And so it will depend, too, on what their electorate was saying to them during their campaign and the feedback that they've got from their own people. As to are they happy with our party coming back in power or not, that I think will decide which sides they actually sit themselves in the end.
Yes, well, you mentioned there might have been a bit of negotiating before the election. What kind of values do you think the coalition is going to be based on? Do you think it'll be like similar policies and manifesto? Could it be ideology, personalities, provincialism?
I think a lot of it's going to be based now on what other issues that have been raised over the last 4 or 5 years now. The complaints by some analysts about important issues to them, which is education, health, infrastructure, of course, and really, really important is employment for our young people. You know, our population is quite high for young people, about, I think, 76% between 15 and 35. These are the people these new MPs will really have to think about, because you can tell from the voting that a lot of the young ones swung the votes in a lot of areas because they wanted certain things out of this election.
Yes, no, you definitely have a point there, that's for sure. Who are Sogavare's main rivals to forming government at the moment in terms of who could potentially become the prime minister?
Ooh, that's a hard question to answer at the moment. As you know, from Solomon Island politics, it's hard to tell. So I think at this point, in terms of numbers, it's, of course, Matthew Wale's group, which is CARE. But then there's also some players in the other group that may be able to convince certain people to move. And as I had alluded to earlier, I said there have been some faces being seen in different lobbying camps that had never been there before. And they've gone to negotiate. So it's going to be, we'll see. We'll have to wait and see.
Is there like an alternative scenario where the CARE Coalition, United Party and Gordon Darcy Lilo and others work together to form their own government?
You know, there's a lot of outstanding issues from before between these parties that need to be resolved if they wanted to work together. And as you know, before they were part of a group and then they all split up and went their own ways and stood on certain principles that some of them might not be able to negotiate or even want to compromise. So I think that's where the difficulty will be. But if they really wanted change and if they really wanted to remove our party, then they'll have to work together.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Kyle Evans and I'm chatting with longtime journalist Dorothy Wickham about the Solomon Islands election vote count, which has just wrapped up. Now, we spoke about the independent MPs a little bit earlier and how they're very much going to be the kingmakers in this election. Does that make things more politically unpredictable or potentially unstable going forward, or could that be a good thing?
Yeah, I think it does cause, you know, a bit of anxiety as to which way this group will go, especially for those who do not want the outgoing government to regain power. But for those who do support the outgoing party, which is our party, they would think this is a good thing because it gives them room to maneuver based on the independents' numbers.
As for the independents that got elected, do they sort of mainly align politically, or do they vary in terms of where their values lie?
They vary a lot. I think some of them sometimes choose to be independent because they're not really sure whether they really want to align themselves to certain party policies until they show that they've got the seat. And I think this is what's happened this time around.
So it still does sound like there's a lot of things still up in the air politically. Is there anything that we do know for certain? You know, like how likely is it that the country is going to have a new prime minister, for instance?
That's not even certain. We need to wait and see now. As you said, it's really fluid and we really need to... things, I think, have to really fall over the next few days. As you know, the caretaker prime minister, Mr. Sogavare, just arrived back in Honiara yesterday, and all the other newly elected MPs will be making their way into Honiara over the next few days to start the lobbying that will form government. So it's fluid.
And just lastly, Dorothy, because we are running out of time, what's been the biggest surprise for you this election? Like, have the results deviated from a direction that you thought they might go?
Yeah, I was really surprised with the election of Mr. Sade, the former Premier of Kodaikanal, running against Bodo Detke. I think that's Northwest Kodaikanal. That was a surprise for me, because I always thought that Bodo had a very strong following in his constituency. However, Sade has proved otherwise.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, look, it very much does sound like it's been an election of surprises, and it's not over yet. Dorothy, fantastic analysis. Thank you so much for joining us on Pacific Beat, and we'll continue to watch closely as those coalition negotiations get underway.
Thank you. Thank you, Kyle. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. That was Dorothy Wickham, who is a longtime journalist in the Solomon Islands. New research into the state of the media in Timor-Leste has found news organisations need to do a better job representing the views of women in reports and news stories. The research, carried out by the Asia Foundation and supported by ABC International Development, found gender stereotypes were common, with blame in areas such as domestic violence reporting commonly attributed to women. The research also spoke about limitations from poor connectivity in the country, which was recently found to have the fourth worst internet in the world. The ABC's Timor-Leste reporter, Vonia Vieira, spoke with Timor-Leste's Press Council President, Otelio Ote, about the findings.
First, this is another opportunity and another success for us. This is another step that important to Timor-Leste to now to know what is the development of media.
Two things, the report on media landscape in Timor-Leste is very important for Press Council and also media in Timor to find solution that can support to develop media in Timor-Leste.
I think yes, because the Press Council sees the establishment until now we didn't have an research. We just get some results of research from other partners like ABCID, and we hope that the information for this research.
So what's your solution from Press Council to support media in Timor-Leste to to struggling to survive for connectivity and approach the government to have the good quality for journalists to do work.
I think as another partners do, including civil society, we always talk to the government in any opportunity that we need to improve the infrastructure and the connection of our internet. We know we have three telecommunication operators, but until now the three operators is same like the same capacity. We hope that and we know that the government promised that maybe 2025 or 2026 we will have a heavy connection of internet because of the submarine. We hope that that will be happen, and at the time the media in Timor-Leste will have another opportunity to increase their capacity or to have a good access for information and something like this. Yeah.
Timor-Leste's Press Council President Otelio Ote speaking there to the ABC's Vonia Vieira.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that honours that tradition, allowing you to hear in-depth personal stories from sports people to farmers, artists to teachers, activists to entrepreneurs, with one thing in common: their Pacific heritage and a unique and incredible story to tell. Stories from the Pacific, Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Hold the front page!
It's time to look at what's been making headlines around the Pacific region. And to do that, I'm joined once again in the chair by producer Mackenzie Smith. Mackenzie, welcome this morning.
Morning, Kyle.
Now, it looks like there's been some more reaction out of Papua New Guinea to US President Joe Biden's cannibals comments.
Yeah, so to refresh, those comments were made last week when, on the campaign trail, Joe Biden, twice in the span of the day, alleged his uncle Ambrose Finnegan Jr. may have been eaten by cannibals when his plane was shot down in PNG during World War II. That's prompted widespread criticism, as we heard earlier, including from PNG Prime Minister James Marape. Now, on Tuesday, the foreign minister, PNG's foreign minister, Justin Tichenko, went further, with Benin News reporting him saying PNG-US relations were at an all-time low and calling for the White House to set the record straight. Official records do show that Finnegan's plane was shot down off the coast of Papua New Guinea and went into the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, he might struggle to live down those comments a little bit, I would say. Now, the Cook Islands Justice Minister has responded to criticism of a controversial cryptocurrency bill there. What's he had to say?
Yeah, so the legislation is called the Tainted Cryptocurrency Recovery Bill, and it's been supported by the Cook Islands government as a necessary measure to prevent financial crime there. But critics say its wording is so broad that it could potentially authorise hacking into other government and university systems all around the world. The Justice Minister, Vane Mac-Mokoroa, told RNZ that although he himself introduced the bill to Parliament, he wasn't consulted on it and he didn't understand the bill when he put it forward. He says he's since been approached by experts and industry members who are concerned about the wording of the bill.
Interesting indeed. And lastly, Pacific delegates are in Ottawa, Canada this week to lead a push for a global treaty on plastic pollution.
Yeah, so those delegates are joining more than 2,000 others representing member states, observer organisations and UN entities at the Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee. Those talks kick off today and will last for 3 days. And at stake is a draft of an internationally binding treaty on dealing with the 350 million metric tons of plastic waste that the world creates every year. The 14 Pacific countries engaged in the process are hoping a deal can be hammered out in Ottawa.
Mackenzie, thank you very much for those stories.
No worries.
That was producer Mackenzie Smith joining us there with NewsWrap.
Are you wanting to break your betel nut addiction, Zumba your way to a fitter you, or get on top of that excruciating case of gout? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has you covered. Pacific Pulse seeks out experts, movers and shakers, and aunties and uncles from across our region to bust open our health issues, challenge taboos, and separate fact from fiction. Join host Melissa Macon on Pacific Pulse Wednesday at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, close to 1,000 health experts and officials, including those from the Pacific, are here in Melbourne for the World Health Summit. The event brings health professionals alongside political leaders to try and find solutions to the biggest health problems facing the world. Joining us this morning is Torres Strait Islander health professional and academic Francis Nonna. Good morning and thank you for joining us, Francis.
Good morning and thank you for having me.
No, not a problem at all. I guess just firstly, summarise the event a bit for us. What's going to be on the agenda?
The World Health Summit comes together in a regional meeting that feeds up to the World Health Organization. So seeing some of the issues within the globe from a regional aspect, that then we look at, it feeds up into the World Health Organization to take from the recommendations of different regions.
Very interesting. So why is Indigenous knowledge important in dealing with the health impacts of the climate crisis?
When we think of Indigenous knowledges, and this is one of the hardest things to get over because what is deemed as evidence, as an Indigenous knower, we've got to draw from these knowledges that have been passed down from generations to now that have, you know, combat the local adaption, holistic approach, sustainable practices. These practices emphasize sustainability and the careful management of natural resources, you know, and the cultural relevance for health interventions that incorporate Indigenous knowledges. And we're starting to see a change where people have sold it as an equilibrium space where Indigenous knowledges are at the table, but it's an unequal space where Indigenous knowledges have been left out, where we are creating policies, but we're not drawing for local knowledges for different regions. And I think this is one of the big key aspects of mine to drive that, you know, these knowledges have to be put into policy for changes.
And how was your message received at events like the World Health Summit?
Yeah, I was starting to see a change where at places like this, there is a great respect for those knowledges, but the key structures are within governments and so forth. But I went to Dubai, COP28, and there was a lot of Indigenous communities fighting the same fight to, you know, emphasise the importance of having their voice at the table. And here at the World Health Summit, it has been great. I follow a lot of Indigenous scholars that are showing the evidence, the importance, you know, the worldview of an Indigenous knower, but also drawing those community local adaptation strategies that are successful to tables like this that then feed up to recommendations to enforce that we have to look at different ways to tackle this climate crisis. If we had to go off the last 20 years and not have those voices there, we are still going to see the same problems. And the people that are being affected are Indigenous communities, the most vulnerable in places that are going to be firstly affected.
Yeah, it's good to hear there's progress being made, but it does sound like there's still work that needs to be done. And just on that, what does still need to be done to get Indigenous leaders to the negotiation table at climate talks?
Yeah, we really have to get it into policy. We really have to get it into the mechanisms that force the changes as we see down to local government areas. And it's really bringing other scholars, bringing other people to advocate that this is an important issue for change. And we have to get to a place where we're not just hearing it, we're starting to embed it. And embedding the Indigenous knowledges into all policy and all local government strategies is where change will happen. So it's starting to get people aware. One of the comments that came out was, how do we get it to evidence? And I said, who's deeming the evidence? You know, as an Indigenous scholar, I'm fighting the fight to my own epistemology, my own methodology, and to deem it as evidence. And we need to get people on board to go, there is strength in this. There is strength in this knowledge that we've got to use for mitigation and adaptation strategies.
What sort of impact does climate change have on Indigenous communities, and how does that compare to non-Indigenous communities?
You know, I think from where I'm from in the Torres Straits, and, you know, just even the media coverage of, you know, in a first world country, Torres Strait could be the first asylum seekers. And, you know, when we think in the Pacific, there are a lot of issues that are happening, and that media coverage is very small. However, you know, when we think of local-based, connection to country and place, why are these people who are so vulnerable having to just go, let's just move? If this happened in the Gold Coast in Queensland and there was, erosion on the beaches, they'll be fixing, they will be there, there'll be attention. But yet these Indigenous communities, you know, who have huge impacts to the local area are not getting the attention or the, yeah. So I just think that there has to be a shift in the way we see it. And the relational bit is, as, you know, just because it's not your region, it's not your area, doesn't mean that you don't give care to it. Because if it was something that would draw money to a state, then we would be making those changes. We would be putting in strategies.
Absolutely. That collective empathy is very important, I think. We know Indigenous communities, that they are at the front line of the climate crisis. Why is good health important for these communities, and how can events such as the World Health Summit help to impact that?
Yeah, Indigenous people, especially within Australia, it's well documented of the comorbidities that Indigenous people face. Well, the climate crisis is going to exacerbate that. And when we think of, you know, just some of the isolations of the regions and the exacerbation of the chronic diseases, we're going to see a real shift where, you know, how do we support these communities when we think, you know, I don't want to make it a deficit mindset, but they're already facing comorbidities with chronic diseases, cardiovascular diseases, renal diseases, and then you throw in climate crisis where access to healthcare, you know, sustainable practices to actually deliver healthcare. And these communities are in so remote regions, it's not just as easy as saying move to the bigger cities and so forth. You know, their families, the connections to countries, and it's how do we deliver healthcare in those regions while sustaining.
And just finally, Francis, what are the next steps for you in spreading the word about Indigenous knowledge and using it to fight health problems brought on by climate change?
Yeah, for me, I lead a project within here in Australia, looking at a rights-based approach. So looking at international mechanisms like the UNDRIP, which is how do we combat at a federal level policies that actually support Indigenous communities. And my PhD, which I'm in, looks at climate and health and how do we embed Indigenous knowledges into policy. But this discussion paper that I will write, hopefully, will start generating the conversation and a coalition with the federal government to say there's international frameworks within the world, Indigenous communities use them. How do we make them value for us? How do we start working alongside the government? And, you know, there was a saying I said in Parliament here in Canberra was, either you work with us or fight us in the courts. We have now come to a place where this is an urgent issue. And that's why we're starting to see court cases starting to show to fight for countries, to fight for our lands.
We wish you the best of luck with that paper, Francis, and we also wish you the best of luck at the World Health Summit in Melbourne. Thank you so much for joining us today on Pacific Beat.
Thank you.
That was Torres Strait Islander health professional and academic Francis Nonna speaking with us there. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at our main story today. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has received a warm welcome to Papua New Guinea, where he's today walking the second leg of a historic trek on the Kokoda Track alongside PNG's Prime Minister James Marape.
You can see from the pictures how Mr. Albanese's presence was embraced by the villagers the Oro way, despite challenges that are still being echoed and are also still some of the biggest challenges in the last couple of years.
PNG reporter Belinda Cora speaking there. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. But stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because the news is next. And coming up after that is Nija Daily. My name's Kyle Evans. Thank you very much for joining me.